KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to another edition of KSL at Night. I am lucky to be joined this evening by Leah Murray, Executive Director of the Walker Institute at Weber State. Leah, good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Greg.
And I'm Greg Skordis, KSL Legal Analyst. Remember, if you missed out on any of our shows, you can always go back and listen to it on kslpodcast.com after the show's been aired. Just look up KSL at Night. So, Leah, the Supreme Court of the United States heard argument today. And by the way, this is the last argument they heard in their current session, the last case that they heard in their current session, which
pause
means,
right there. Does that mean anything?
No.
Okay.
It's just they're done. They've now heard all their arguments. Now we're going to start seeing the opinions come out.
But it's not like they were stalling.
Saving the best for last.
It's just this is the order it came in. This is when they happen to hear the case.
Right. And this one involves, I actually think there's a good answer to that. This one involves the immunity claim by President Trump for his prosecution as it relates to the efforts that he allegedly took to set aside the 2020 election. The reason I think this was heard last is because it's moved on such a fast track that it went through the various court systems on its way up. So if you recall, Leah, he is charged in the D.C. federal courts with conspiring to defraud the government, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and two counts of corruptly obstructing a congressional proceeding. So, four counts, four felonies, and he's facing charges there in the federal court in D.C. Circuit.
And so this, what we're talking about, that has to do with election
right.
shenanigans,
it was
right?
It was his efforts to allegedly set aside the 2020 election. When he's traveling around, he's making overtures to Vice President Pence to do certain things to set aside the election. He's asking electors to do to set aside what they think their states have voted for.
Right. But this is not the Georgia case.
Correct.
This is not the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago case.
Correct.
And it's not the Manhattan hush money case.
The one that's going. Right.
So what we're talking about is former President Trump is asking for absolute immunity, but just for this one set of criminal charges.
Correct.
All right, go.
Correct. So the Supreme Court narrowed that exact question that you just said, Leah, to the following question. Whether and to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? So if you look at it that way, it's not blanket immunity. It's immunity from criminal prosecution, conduct alleged to involve official acts, and during his tenure in office. So it's not blanket immunity, but it's limited, but it still deals with immunity for a president for acts he allegedly committed while he was in office.
So pause right there. So
sure.
You said the Supreme Court narrowed the question.
Right.
So does that mean that former President Trump was asking for blanket immunity?
Yes, absolutely.
And then they said, we will hear this, but only on this particular point.
Correct.
So that means they've said no to the rest of it.
Correct.
Okay.
They're not going to give anybody blanket immunity. They made that very clear. So the case ran through as it's supposed to, the various stages. He goes to the trial court. The trial court judge says, no, immunity doesn't apply here. We're going to trial. He goes to the D.C. Circuit. Three-judge panel there unanimously agrees there is no immunity. So he appeals it one step further to the Supreme Court, and they sort of articulated that particular issue, and they heard the arguments on that today.
All right, so I want to hear from President Trump why he thinks he has immunity.
If you don't have immunity, you're not going to do anything. You're going to become a ceremonial president. You're just going to be doing nothing. You're not going to take any of the risks, both good and bad.
All right. So his argument, I think, is really a president should have full executive autonomy, if you will, so they can trial all the things they want to do, under the assumption that the next person elected couldn't then criminally prosecute you for stuff you did while president.
Yeah, especially if it's a bitter rival or opponent from an opposite party, there was some difficulty there saying, wait a minute, you can't just prosecute me because you didn't like what I did while I was in office.
And let's listen to one of our justices, Alito, who I think maybe agrees with him.
If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?
So you're making a face, Greg. What is that face?
I mean, we've had presidents for, what, 250 years, and we haven't had criminal prosecutions. So we're all looking at this particular case and this particular situation as, oh, boy, this is creating a huge problem. It's not a problem. Trump was an anomaly. Let's just face it. I mean, whether you like him or not, I mean, he was an anomaly. He's been charged with four different criminal prosecutions. That's not just happenstance. That's not just the Democrats. And maybe I'm taking a position that's going to get me in trouble. But Georgia, Florida, federal courts in New York, federal courts in D.C. I mean, this is where everybody. I listen to all these arguments, Trump and Alito, and we've got others who are saying, boy, this is really going to make it difficult for presidents in the future. I don't agree with that because this is not going to happen again. It's really not.
All right. So let's listen to Justice Kavanaugh and what his concern is.
The problem is the vague stat, you know, obstruction and 371 conspiracy to defraud the United States can be used against a lot of presidential activities historically with a creative prosecutor who wants to go after a president.
So I think
that's exactly what I just said.
Yeah,
but,
no.
Go ahead.
Right. So his worry is, right, isn't Kavanaugh arguing it's a vague the way that they've defined it, right? And so what we need to do is, maybe it's the case there can be criminal prosecutions, but we need a really narrow definition.
Sure.
So that you couldn't just have a fishing expedition, if you will, right? So I can't be hiring a special counsel to be looking back at the former president. I guess I'm not persuaded, Greg, by your claim that this is just President Trump. I mean, I guess I feel like it's possible he could have started it, right? So he's the anomaly that has 91 criminal trial, right? But now it's a thing. So if you feel
good
like,
point.
Right, like, so that
just
I'm
just like
thinking,
impeachment seems to be the new, one of the things we do now.
Right. So the answer is, if Joe Biden loses in November and Trump has told us that he will go after crooked Biden and the Biden family, a little bit, I think. Right. Like, so I want to just kind of put the shoe on the other foot. Right.
Sure.
So maybe let's make it not about Trump. Should we be worried about Biden being criminally prosecuted for decisions that he made, for risks that he may have taken? Right. That maybe this immunity actually is a good idea.
You know, I'll just say it from this perspective. I've practiced law for 42 years in the criminal justice system, both as a prosecutor and a defense attorney. And in America, the accused is presumed innocent, and that presumption continues. And I'll tell you my point here in a minute. Until 12 people unanimously agree beyond a reasonable doubt that he or she is guilty. So it's not like you can just bring charges against a former president. We still have the Constitution. We still have the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. We still have the presumption of innocence. And I mean, you can't just bring a criminal case because you don't like somebody. You better get a strong case that you have a chance to win.
So your argument actually right there, Greg, is this isn't and never was a fishing expedition. That built into the judicial system is already protections against what Kavanaugh and Alito are referring to.
Yeah, I think that's my position just based on my experience. So anyway, let's stay with Trump on trial and talk about the case that is currently pending after the break.
KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas, as we're talking about the most interesting things that are happening. So, Greg, we have been chatting about the former president and his trial. I wanted to ask you a question about that. So Donald Trump can't be at the Supreme Court for that case that we just talked about in the last segment because he's in New York City. And he kind of complained today, like he was like, I would be there, but I have to be here for this. But real quick, he wouldn't actually be there. There are no witnesses in a case before the Supreme Court, right? So it wouldn't be the case that his attorney would be wandering into the Supreme Court building with Donald Trump.
No, but he would be there as a spectator, just like everyone else. I mean, you can attend court. It's open to the public. So I think what he was saying was, I would be there to cheer on my people and to make comment after it's over, to give my, to just have my face there.
Gotcha,
no,
gotcha.
He's not a witness.
Yeah.
He's a party to the case, but the Supreme Court doesn't have it. testimony or evidence at all.
Yeah, could you even imagine ever in history a president being at the Supreme Court while they are listening to a case? Like, I can't name another president who did that.
Probably not. I can't think of one
either. So that would be totally out of the norm.
Right.
So let's just kind of sit there for just a second about what you said, that Trump is an anomaly. So when I just said he's out of the norm, he is. He's an anomaly. When we are thinking about these cases, let's listen to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and what she's worried about.
Let me put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office?
Right. So she's doing the flip of what I said, right? So earlier I was saying, if we don't have immunity, the worry is for every president, every decision they're making. It's kind of like if the other party didn't impeach me, when the other party gets into the presidency, then they will prosecute. She's got the flip argument basically is if we take immunity off the or like leave immunity on the table, right? Then it is the case that that presidents might just commit crimes all over the place because they're not even worried about what is criminal.
But I think that's, I mean, come on. Presidents will just commit crimes, what does she say, with abandon while they're in office? I mean, that's as ridiculous as the arguments that have been made on the other side that, well, presidents can't do anything. They're hamstrung the whole time they're in office and while they're in office. And she say, well, they could just commit crimes all day. We elect these people because they have some level of morality, some level of ethics, and there is oversight, there's impeachment, there's re-election, there's your history. How are you going to be perceived? I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons why an elected official, especially the president of the United States, has all kinds of reasons not to commit crime while in office.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you leaned hardcore into democracy
there.
Yeah,
I know.
This idea that voters are always going to be discerning of who the best candidates should be, or that even voters get to see the best candidates, right? So I think right now we have 2020 rematch. 75% of voters don't want either of these candidates to win. So I'm not persuaded by what you just said. I think you're not wrong that maybe that's making the straw man, right, on the other side. I think that's fair. But let's talk a little bit about crimes that presidents might commit, right? So when we think about former President Trump, he is on trial today in Manhattan. So let me ask you, as our legal analyst at KSL, where are we? Like, you always tell me, the day of the week of the trial. Like, so what day are we? What week are we? Where are we at in this trial in Manhattan?
Yeah, so the jury was selected last week. We finally got to a witness on Friday. So today's Thursday, so we're on week two, essentially, day four. And the state is still putting on its case. This is the state of New York. This is not a federal case like the one we've been talking about involving presidential immunity. This is the state case brought in Manhattan against Donald Trump for crimes related to the hush money payments and whether or not those were misleading, whether the way he articulated those in his books and records was a fraud on the election to avoid embarrassment during the election.
By the way, we're talking about the 2016 election.
Correct.
So he wasn't president yet.
Right.
So if the Supreme Court, even if they ruled have absolute immunity, it wouldn't apply to this hush money case because he wasn't president yet.
Great point. That's a great point. Yes.
So the answer would be, but had he been president when he paid the hush money,
maybe.
That's what Ketanji Brown Jackson's worried about, right? That you might start doing that.
Okay. Oh, that's a great point. Yes, he doesn't even raise the immunity issue in the New York case. He's saying, you know, I didn't have immunity. I was Trump the citizen. I was Trump the political candidate, and I was trying to keep this embarrassing information out of the public light. And so the issue is whether his attorney Cohen or the then leader of the National Enquirer, I think his name is David Pecker, conspired with Trump to do this, catch and kill. You buy a story, but then you don't allow it to become public because you purchased the rights to the story for, I think they paid, allegedly, Stormy Daniels $130,000, but didn't really give us a very clear understanding of where that money came from and how it was paid. Because Cohen, his attorney, who he's just slammed the guy because he is a convicted liar. Let's face it, the government doesn't like witnesses who are convicted liars, but you got to take the medicine you're given, is going to say that he was sending Trump bills ostensibly as attorney's fees when they really weren't. He was just funneling through the Stormy Daniels people to usher up.
Right. So I want to circle back a little bit, and then we'll kind of get into what you were just going there. You were saying they chose a jury last week. One of the things that I thought was interesting, and we talked about this last week, Greg, was that they asked the jurors what their opinions were of Trump. And you thought that was, how did you say? Like, we don't usually do that, right? So you're not usually asking, but maybe it's because it's Trump, because he's famous. But another question that came out in the last week that I hadn't heard when we talked about this last time, and I wanted to get your thought on it, was jurors were asked about where they got their news. So what I thought was interesting, there is a chart, right, that you can find in any news source that tells you of these jurors and alternates where they get their information, right? And that ranges from the BBC to Fox News. I'm going to tell you what, most of them get it from the New York Times, which, by the way, makes sense to me because they live in New York City, right? So like a little bit, that's like their Salt Lake Trib. Does that make sense? Like it is a national paper for us, but it is a local paper for them. What do you think about that? Is that weird that they would be asking them where they get their news? And what on earth would a criminal defense attorney care about that for?
I've done 200 jury trials. I would say in 198 of those, the jurors were asked what is their source of information. In fact, I can't think of one where we didn't.
This is totally normal.
This is absolutely normal. And you look at it. Well, I read the Deseret News. I read the Tribune. I get my information from Fox News. I mean, you can tell a little bit about it. I mean, I had a jury once where the guy's got his source of information from Soldier of Fortune magazine. You know what I mean? Like, that person may have a different angle. You know, the NRA Journal and church magazines, you know, religious magazines, things like that. They tell you a little bit about a person, just sort of where they're leaning. And by the way, I will say this, the majority of people will say, and I'm not just plugging us, KSL. I get my information from KSL. I mean, they say that all the time.
All right. Given what you just said, it happens all the time. So clearly you're an expert at using media sources to discern, in your crystal ball, what that person's talking about. If a juror says, I get all of my information from Truth Social and X.
You're going to worry a little bit. You're going to worry because I don't know. But that's just my age showing because maybe we were. It's the same, I guess, as if somebody said, I get most of my news from National Enquirer and People. And, you know, like, so are you really getting an accurate, because to me, I think of the local media in Utah as being pretty fair and accurate.
So they say KSL, you're like, we're good.
Yeah. I mean, or even some of the competitors, you really think that way. But it is interesting to note what people are saying, how they're answering those questions. And some people will say, I mean, it's obviously changed in the 42 years I practiced because people weren't getting their information on Facebook when I started practicing law, but a lot of people get their news from Facebook or things like that. You're kind of like, well, you know, that's tainted, but what does that mean? So you know what I mean? You still have to look at it as an attorney where you're striking the juror. Well, so they get their information from a certain source, X, Facebook. I don't know. Does that make them more or less likely to side with a certain side?
Yeah. So we've got like, you know, half a minute left, Greg. So make this one tight. How does it matter the way that Trump is behaving? So there is a gag order violation ruling that is also, we're waiting for that answer to come down. What does it mean for, if he were your client, would you be telling him to be quiet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you hope that the jury is following the admonition of the court and not paying attention to outside sources. So they're looking at this case in a vacuum. They're looking at what's before them. They don't know what's going on, the shenanigans by anybody before and after court while we're waiting for the day of trial to begin.
All right. Next up on KSL at Night, listeners, I want to stay in New York's courts because another high profile convicted felon
came right out
of the blue, and we're going to talk about it.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night alongside Leah Murray. I'm your host this evening, legal analyst Greg Skordas. And I'm going to jump into another legal case, Leah, that you probably haven't thought about for a long time. And that is Harvey Weinstein. Remember that?
Did I just throw up a little bit in my mouth?
Right.
I did.
Had the worst reputation, created this whole Me Too movement. And
Greg, he did not create it. He is the
I overstated that. Yeah. But he made that on the forefront of our public attention, it seemed like. It was really a big deal.
His horrible behavior made everyone realize, maybe men shouldn't treat women this way.
Right. Anyway, the New York Court of Appeals overturned his conviction on sex crimes against three women, finding that the judge erroneously admitted the testimony of uncharged alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than those complaining. In other words, and it's a phenomena that we do in America, Leah, where we have what we call propensity witnesses, witnesses who will come in and testify, well, he did the same thing to me. And so therefore you think, well, that's part of his modus operandi. That's part of what he is. That's part of what he does. That's part of his scheme. It's how he gets people to do certain things. The judges in that case, it was a 4-3 opinion, said, no, that evidence shouldn't have been admitted. His conviction is set aside. And maybe we can break it down a little bit better with our guest, ABC News entertainment correspondent, Jason Nathanson. Jason, thank you for joining us this evening.
Sure. Happy to be here.
And I'm sorry to jump into the legalese of this, but what does this mean for Harvey Weinstein? And I say that knowing that he's already convicted in California, too. So it's not like he's just walking home tonight.
Yeah. So the conviction's overturned, and he was serving a 23-year sentence in New York. And so under that appeal and everything being overturned now, if that were the only case, he would probably be able to walk out of prison at some point. But that's not the case because of what's happening in California here, where he is also facing a 16-year prison sentence. So he'll be transferred from New York to California. But we'll also see if this appeal or if this the overturn of this conviction has any bearing on his appeal here in California now, because it could possibly. Because his lawyers are already, they're sharpening their pens as they write their appeal, saying that, look, the case in California, which came after the New York case, and the jurors in the California case, they convicted him partly because of what they saw as precedents in the New York case. So, and also both of those cases did have those witnesses who did testify who were not part of the charges in both cases. So they have a lot more grounds here at this point in California, and we'll see if that has any bearing. But for now, Weinstein is facing another 16 years in California, which, given what we know about his health, the New York conviction was supposed to be basically a death sentence. The California one, for him at 72 years old and in bad health, 16 years, probably not in the cards for him to make it another 16 years.
So, Jason, this opinion was a 4-3 opinion from New York State's highest court, right? So my question is, one, like, does it go anywhere, right? Does New York then appeal up into the federal courts, or does it just kind of, this is the end of it? And two, it is divided, and it feels like they were, I don't know, like, it doesn't, like, not that it matters,
case,
right?
Yep.
It's binary. It's either either it is or it's not, but it does feel like it's controversial. Can you just kind of speak to just, is it over in New York, or is there something there that's going to happen further in that state?
It's not over. It goes back to the prosecutors in Manhattan who have said that they will do everything within their power to retry this case. So that'll depend on the witnesses. If they want to go through all of this again, it'll be another long and lengthy process. But, it should be of note in the opinion, it wasn't about whether or not Harvey Weinstein did it or didn't do it. That wasn't necessarily at issue there. It was about the evidence that was introduced and whether or not that prejudiced the jury, which they did, which in the 4-3 opinion, they found that it did. So the evidence that they have, can they make the case with the three women that they have, and not including the testimony of the extra three women who testified but were not a part of the charges? Can they make their case? The prosecutors in Manhattan say that they can. But again, does everybody want to go through that again? That's what we'll see what the next step is.
Can I just follow up on that right there, Jason? So the answer is, if they can now, then why did they have the three extra witnesses that caused this to be thrown out? You know what I mean? Like, why were they necessary the first time?
I'm not part of the prosecution team, so I can't really speak to that. But I mean, in any court case, you want to make the strongest case that you possibly can. And there were, especially when it comes to Harvey Weinstein, there were dozens upon dozens of people who said that they, that he did the same thing to them. So they want to make their case. They want to make it as strong as possible. But that does obviously open them up to this prejudicial argument, which came back and bit them, and which the lawyers, Harvey Weinstein lawyers, they had argued at the time, saying, hey, why are you allowing this stuff? This is just prejudicial and it's not part of the case. It's not part of the charges. Yes, it does go to establish some pattern of behavior against Weinstein, but it wasn't germane specifically to the actual case that at hand.
And that's a great point, Jason. So, and I'll follow up a little bit, Leah. When the state puts on its case, it gives the defense a list of all its witnesses. And I'm sure, as Jason just indicated, the defense said, "Hey, you can't call these people. They're not germane. They're not relevant to the inquiry. And they don't even show a propensity. You should not allow them." That was vetted with the trial court judge, and he or she said, "You know what? I am going to let them testify." That was preserved as an appellate issue, and the appeals court said, "No, trial judge, you got that part of it wrong." So they're going to, and I think Jason said it really well. Now the state of New York has to decide whether or not they're going to retry the case. And it seems, Jason, that they're at least hinting that they do want to retry it. But again, I think you said they may be going back to the victims and saying, "Hey, do you really want to go through this again?" Is that your take on it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, their language was as strong as possible. They are going to retry this and do everything within their power to retry the case. But they left that door open saying, you know, it might not be possible. And in terms of the witnesses, like you mentioned there, they give this list of witnesses. And there were many witnesses that were excluded. It was, you know, whittled down to these three extra witnesses that were allowed. And same thing in California as well. I think there were four of those similar witnesses that were allowed out of, you know, maybe a dozen or so that were not allowed. So again, we'll see what kind of case they come up with and whether or not everybody wants to participate again.
Yeah. So Jason, I'm so sorry to ask this question, but like, I got to tell you, hearing Harvey Weinstein's name in the news again just made me go, ugh, right? So I wasn't expecting this, but obviously, right, his lawyers would have been working in this case in New York, and maybe I just didn't hear about it. So is it the case that you can say we definitely have a case coming up in California, or we won't know until all of a sudden it's thrown out the same way as in New York?
His lawyers here in California are working on an appeal as we speak. So it's possible that we could see this happen all over again. It's going, you know, they're going to file, and whether or not that goes to the court, whether or not that goes to the courts here, the higher courts here in California, we'll see. But you can be sure that it is going to be filed.
And I would just say this, Jason, and to follow up on something you said, New York law, California law might be different, and California Supreme Court or Court of Appeals might interpret their character evidence, propensity evidence a little different than New York did. So just because it was set aside in New York doesn't necessarily mean California will do the same thing. But it does give his attorneys there, don't you think, Jason, a little more leverage to say, "Hey, wait a minute, we got to do this as well."
Absolutely. Different cases, different circumstances, although very similar all around. But it does give them at least precedence, right? And, you know, you being the legal expert, I'm not just a reporter covering this stuff, but precedence is huge, right, when it comes to a lot of these cases, and hanging it on previous rulings and case law and things like that. That's what they're looking for. So it's not like they were going to appeal here in California anyway.
Sure.
But now they're going into it. Now they have, you know, a couple of extra bullets in their bag.
Absolutely. Jason Nathanson, ABC News. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Sure thing. Take care.
That's interesting. It really is. That was a good breakdown. After the break, let's talk about Biden signing a new law to ban TikTok.
KSL at night. KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas. And Greg, yesterday I got a text from KSL News Radio that said Biden just signed a bill that could potentially lead to a ban of TikTok. Here's what I'm going to tell you, listeners. If you want to get a text like that so you know all of the things, you should send into 57500 the word breaking, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G. So let me say that better. Text that word breaking into 57500 and you will start getting all the newsworthy stuff. No matter where you are, you'll know what's happening. And I reacted to this. I like TikTok, Greg.
Well, you can still like TikTok and you can still enjoy TikTok, but he didn't ban TikTok. He just said if TikTok wants to involve itself in the United States, it has to divest itself of Chinese ownership. So they're saying we feel like TikTok is a let's face it, a Chinese company, that they're gathering information about America youth, that they're doing things that perhaps they shouldn't be, and we need to separate that governmental interest in that entity from its ownership. And so they're saying, look, TikTok, if you want to stay in business in the United States, you've got to have a non-Chinese entity that owns you.
Yeah, so let's listen to TikTok CEO Xiao Chu talk about what the response is going to be.
Rest assured, we aren't going anywhere. We are confident and we will keep fighting for your rights in the courts. The facts and the Constitution are on our side.
All right, Greg, legal analyst for KSL. Are the facts and the Constitution on TikTok's side? Like, so is it the case that the government can tell multinational corporations who they get to hang out with multinationally? And do they then get to tell you what you get to post on TikTok?
I think what he's saying in terms of the Constitution is the First Amendment. And I think that what Congress is saying, well, we still have the right to protect the public. And so those are countervailing, perhaps, issues when you deal with the rights of the people versus the rights of ownership of companies, that type of thing. So I think this is one's a little bit on shaky ground, and I appreciate
what's on shaky ground. The new law
okay, that bans it. I don't know that the Supreme Court, of course, we have a unusual Supreme Court. Who knows where they're coming with something like this? But I think it's going to go through the courts. I'm sure there's already been a lawsuit filed. It's got to start somewhere, work itself up to the Supreme Court, or at least of certain states, or the state that it's filed in, maybe the United States Supreme Court. And we will have a constitutional question whether or not that is constitutionally allowed to force a company to have that is arguably owned by a foreign country to maintain its ownership in that country.
All right. So TikTok has been on notice, as Greg said. They've got to get themselves disconnected from ByteDance. So it's not TikTok that's the Chinese company. It's actually ByteDance.
Right, exactly. Yes.
That is the Chinese company. Or the ban will come on January 19th of 2025. So what I hear the CEO saying is they are going to sue. They're not going the route of disconnecting from ByteDance. And let's hear what the status of TikTok is in the meantime.
While we make our case in court, you'll still be able to enjoy TikTok like you always have.
So the answer is, I guess.
Well, we have until January 19th of 2025, at least.
To enjoy it.
Right. But that gives TikTok two options. One, find new ownership, which they're basically saying we're not going to do, but you can bet that they're looking around. And two, to get it through the courts. And to their credit, Congress and the president, it didn't just shut them down next Thursday. So they do recognize that there are issues here. They do recognize, hey, let's give them a chance to get their new ownership. Or, and the alternative, let's give it a chance to work its way through the court system and see what happens. So, yeah, I mean, the January 19th of 2025 is pretty far away, and it should give us plenty of time to sort through those two issues, either new ownership or the court saying you can't do this.
So let me just ask a question right there. Isn't it kind of the job of Congress to prove that there is an issue before they can issue a ban like this?
Absolutely. But there were some hearings, as I recall, where they have very, what I believe Congress thinks, they have clear evidence that this is Chinese-owned, that it is gathering information about American youth. I mean, Congress did its homework. Whether it was accurate or not, I'm not going to say, because I don't know what they relied on. But they didn't just pull this out of the air. I mean, people will say this about companies from China that are owned privately, that they're really part of the state. They're really part of the Chinese government, no matter how you say it. So then you look at TikTok, ByteDance, you look at what they're gathering, what they're doing, their algorithms, and I think Congress did enough studies and they had enough people to look at it to say they're more than just producing information. Because I think there was somebody that testified, you know, my kid watches some certain thing and boy, they know exactly what you like, what you're looking at, and they can hit you with that over and over and over again. And what does that do to a person's mind when you're starting to flood them with certain information?
Right, but isn't that also true about Instagram?
Absolutely.
So my question for you is, if the claim is not about the mental health crisis, so to be fair, in the state of Utah, I feel like the claim is about that.
Right.
And so Utah is kind of going after all these companies for that reason. But this is a We've picked on you because we think you are connected to China. So we have made it a national security issue, right? Like, it's not just a mental health issue. It is a national security issue. Don't they have to prove it?
They do. And that's where they're going to be tied up in the courts. Right. Gotcha. Now, they think that they've got enough evidence to support the law. And TikTok's going to come in and say, where's your evidence? Show us your proof and show us how you got to this point. We know in America in 2024, there is this paranoia about China right now. I mean, it's probably our most frightening adversary, more so than Russia. It's just become that way. And, you know, we have spy balloons flying all over. We have Chinese involvement in certain things, buying properties, looking at things like that. I think there's a real fear of China right now. And that's pervaded into Congress, the presidency. I mean, nobody's saying China's our best friend. And China hasn't done anything to make themselves our best friend. So, yeah, there's some paranoia here. And I think that's what's playing out.
So how does that work going forward? So, and again, I want to be clear. And actually, let me let TikTok CEO Xiao Chu make this case.
It's actually ironic because the freedom of expression on TikTok reflects the same American values that make the United States a beacon of freedom.
Right. And ahead of that, he says it's disappointing, right? This is a disappointing moment. And on my TikTok feed are all sorts of American business people who have made their living and who make their living.
And they're really upset.
Really upset.
Point. That's a great
point. On TikTok, kind of talking about this. And a little bit, I just wonder, you know, to a certain extent, I think we always have a conversation in this country around to what extent our freedoms have to be curtailed to keep us safe. So you started this whole thing by saying Congress has a job. It's got to keep the people safe. But, safe for the point of safety should never, I don't think. So let's just kind of talk about it. It feels like it's anti-capitalist, right? Because it's stepping into a business and telling a business what to do.
Right.
It feels like it's anti-entrepreneurship because it's stepping into all these small businesses that are running on TikTok and making it so that they can't do the job. It also feels like it's a First Amendment about speech. So
that's
if I want to put a video on TikTok, I should be allowed to. How do they win? So when they file a lawsuit, Greg, where does it go? Does it go immediately to the Supreme Court?
And
then
no.
What does that look like? And then how does TikTok defend itself?
They file it in the trial court. We want a trial. We want a hearing. We want evidence. We want to put on witnesses to show that that this law was wrong, that it was wrong-minded. And they will ask for a preliminary injunction in that court saying, look, until the issues are vetted, until the trial is heard, we want you, judge, trial court judge, not Supreme Court judge, to put a stay on this January 19th execution date for TikTok and saying, look, we need to vet the issues here. That could take a year or longer. The judge in that case will probably grant some level of injunction and say, look, I'm not going to let this law go into effect until we have the issues heard. They'll have a trial. Probably the judge will hear the issues, say, okay, Congress, you had enough evidence to do what you did. And then it'll go through the appeal system or you didn't have enough.
All right. So next up on KSL at Night, Greg, we're talking about security and national security. One of the most maybe imminent issues, quite frankly, is probably not TikTok, but actually our border and border security. And it's become a flashpoint in this national election that we've got going. Ads that we see in Utah are talking about
political
it.
Political
ads. Yeah, let's get into it. Yep. Yeah, let's get into it. Stay with us after the break.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
And you're back with us on KSL at Night for the second hour of the most interesting news on the air. And I'm Greg Skordis alongside Leah Murray. Leah, you sort of introduced this topic as we were breaking after the last segment, but immigration has become a hot topic issue in this year's election, probably as much as it's ever been. And if you look at some of the ads, especially for our national offices, obviously, congressional offices, Senate, people are hitting immigration hard. And it's also a subject that's been tough on the current administration. Biden has taken a hit on his approach to immigration. Some of his executives have taken a hit on their approaches to immigration. And certain states have said, look, the
the administration's not doing his job. So I'm talking about Texas. We're going to bring national, we're going to do it ourselves. You know, we're going to take care of this ourselves.
I mean, like the only department secretary in American history, Mayorkas, who was impeached over this particular issue. The impeachment doesn't go anywhere. He doesn't get convicted. But the answer is this is a problem. I think Texas had 350,000 people trying to cross the border in December. The issue, I think, for Joe Biden is he's trying to wait or make claims that he's waiting for Congress to act. And I'm not sure. Look, when there's a problem, a little bit, we expect our president to solve it.
Just
does that make sense
and
do something?
Right. And he hasn't. But somebody who has is our next guest. We're joined this evening by Brad Bonham, a Utah RNC committeeman. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate you guys having me on.
And so tell our listeners this. What is RNC National Committeeman? Let's start with that, because I think we all know what it is, but maybe our listeners don't.
Well, Greg, I was going to say, how long do we have? But actually, I can boil this down into a couple of key points. So I am one of three people from the state of Utah that get to represent the Utah Republican Party, but on the national stage. So I am a member of the RNC, as well as our GOP chair, Rob Axon, and Anne-Marie Limpropoulos, our committee woman. And so we get to preach the gospel of what makes Utah great and hopefully spread that to the rest of the country.
All right. So a couple of weeks ago, Brad, I interviewed Congresswoman Malloy because she had also gone on a trip to the border. And one of the things I asked her was, like, what did you see while you were there? So I'll ask you the same thing. When you traveled to the border, you know, what were you seeing? You know, like, what was going on?
So I was actually there with Congresswoman Malloy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. And a couple of our amazing sheriffs from here in Utah came down with me. And I would say what I saw was substantially more concerning than what I had even thought we were going to see. We met with Sheriff Daniels of the Cochise County Sheriff's Office, a great man, loves our country. We met with a number of his law enforcement personnel, and they escorted us along a long section of the border. And what was really kind of stood out to me, we watched actually in real time through their camera system as people just walked across the border. There was large open sections with no wall, no gates, no border patrol. You can just walk into our country. And it was very alarming. I didn't realize how easy it was to get into the United States and how few resources currently we have, deployed to keep our borders secure. So that was probably the most alarming thing to me.
So Brad, without necessarily pointing fingers, why is this the case? Why is it so easy to enter our country right now? And maybe to some of us, maybe it's always been easy. We just haven't been aware of it. But what's going on that's causing this to be such a concern?
Well, here's something really fascinating that I learned, because I think Trump, when he ran, you know, it was build the wall. What I didn't understand until I was actually down there was President Obama has built a huge chunk of the border wall. And so as we were driving along the border, we drove miles and miles and miles. The sheriff was pointing out, he said, this is the Obama wall, and here's where Trump took over the wall. And so it wasn't a Democrat versus Republican thing until, you know, very recently. Like, both of those presidents understood the value in securing our border. And you know, Trump made it kind of a rallying cry. And now we're honestly doing nothing to secure the border. I mean, that's really what I took away. I don't know why. Like, I can't answer that question succinctly, but it is very concerning. We have large sections of border fence that we have paid hundreds of millions of dollars for that is just sitting, lying there. I have you know, hours of footage of just, you know, unbuilt border wall, and it's very concerning.
Brad, can you talk to me about, so when, and I'm not asking you to defend President Biden, I just don't misunderstand my question, but like, he's making the claim that Congress needs to give more specific rules, right? Or he's waiting for congressional action. I am persuaded that that might not be the right move anyway, but can you help us understand why, like, what would he be looking for Congress to do? Does that make sense? What is the, like, what would be left? Does Congress have to make some new rules? Is it about long-term immigration reform? Like, what is he looking for?
So I don't know that President Biden, I guess, if he's blaming Congress for what's going on. I mean, he the first week in office, and this again, I'm just returning and reporting, and, yeah. and you know, from what I heard from law enforcement, the first week in office, Joe Biden rescinded kind of the emergency funding that Donald Trump had put in place, and that essentially, in part, defunded a lot of the law enforcement efforts and certainly the wall construction that existed there. So I actually think the president of the United States can do a lot to help this border crisis. And at a bare minimum, he can, you know, use the bully pulpit to rally people around this. And so I don't quite buy it, quite frankly. And this I'm really trying hard not to be partisan here. The president's job is to secure our country and keep us safe. And I talking to the law enforcement, these guys are heroes, and they are working 20-hour days, and they are trying to get bad guys off the streets, and they have lost just citizens. Every time they try to pull over an illegal driver, by the way, they run. They're given the instructions by the cartel, just floor it and go. And so they've lost, I think, 23 people in the last 2 years in Cochise County have been hit by illegals and killed. And it's just shocking, like, this is going on in our amazing country.
Brad, let me ask you this. You speak to a lot of people. You're involved a lot in Utah politics. In terms of election issues coming up, we've got the economy. We've got the rising debt ceiling. We've got the abortion issue. Where does immigration stand, do you think, with the American public as it goes to the ballot box this next November?
You know, Greg, I personally think that this issue alone, and while those other issues I care deeply about, I'm very pro-choice. I love our free market capitalist society where we try to take care of each other, hopefully. I think this issue is what will cause Joe Biden to lose the election. And I've heard it even, you'll hear Democrats on the House floor say, hey, we got to get going on this issue. You know, like, these poll numbers are terrible, and in large part because it doesn't appear like our president and his administration really care much about it. And you know, according to my sheriff friends down there, he doesn't. You know, they do not feel supported in these efforts.
Interesting. Well, we'll see how that plays out. Brad Bonham, thank you for joining us this evening on KSL at Night. And thanks for what you do for our state.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Leah.
Do you agree with that, Leah? Do you agree that that's a big issue? Because it seems to be. I mean, otherwise, I can't imagine why some of these politicians are hitting that.
I think one of the things that happened during the Trump administration is that the left wing of the Democratic Party made it an argument that it's immoral to have border security. So I think they tied up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like the having any border security was an immoral thing to do. I think they're wrong. And I think the pulling back of the funding that Brad talks about leads to law enforcement not being supported. And it has probably directly led to this crisis. And someone has to say, having border security is not necessarily immoral. How we do it might have some moral reflections, but not the security itself.
Yep. When we come back after the break, I want to pick your brain on this one, Leah. We're talking about universities and what's going on campuses right now. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas, and we're talking about all the interesting things you need to know to be able to be having good conversations out in your community. And Greg, one of the ways that I know all the newsworthy things that I need to know is I get texts from KSL News Radio. Do you?
I get them every day.
Every day. They send you some kind of, here's a breaking news thing.
And you see that 57500, you want to click on it. You want to see what's going on.
I love that.
I do anyway.
My favorite is because sometimes they're like, there was a car crash, or you know what I mean? Like, no. I-15 is closed.
Yesterday was on my way home, so it saved me about 30 minutes.
It was very helpful. If you want to get these texts, like Greg and I do, you want to hear the newsworthy things, what we need you to do is text the word breaking, BREAKING, to 57500. So text the word breaking to 57500. And then just like Greg, when you see 57500 come up on your phone, you can smile. Because Greg smiled when he said it, and you can feel good and click on it and know that there's a car accident.
That's right.
Or that we just got the Coyotes. Or that
we just got a new hockey team. Yeah.
Whatever else is going on.
Sure.
All right. So, Greg, one of the things that we have been talking about a bit for the last like 7 months is this conflict in Gaza. Right. So what's happening there, if you haven't been paying attention, is there was an attack at a music festival. Hamas took hostages. That resulted in Israel basically saying, we are going to defend ourselves. And they have been. There are some questions as to whether the response is too strong or
whether it's targeted or whether it's targeted. A group it shouldn't
yeah.
be.
And what's happening there. And the answer really from the United States point of view is we are pro Israel. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to tell you what, listeners, with the Biden administration, we are pro-Ukraine. We are pro-Israel. We are going to be pro-Taiwan if China decides to move into Taiwan. This legislation we talked about earlier that would ban TikTok, the other part of that legislation, the compromise of banning TikTok, was to say, I got funding for Ukraine. I got funding for Israel. I got funding for Taiwan. So this is the United States in its global leadership position saying these are the countries we defend. These are our friends. These are our allies. As it turns out, in the United States, these have become a little bit partisan, right, Greg? So it's interesting to me, and we'll kind of put one real quick on the table, but Republicans are not as supportive of supporting Ukraine, so they're not there for Ukraine. But a little bit, I'll tell you what, the progressive left is not as supportive of supporting Israel. So what I think is kind of the Biden administration move, which is we see these all of one piece, right? That these are our allies. They have been attacked. Taiwan, not yet, but let's hope it never happens. But if it does, we are going to defend them. Republican and Democratic leaders in our Congress agree, right? So you've got Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer on the same page. But when it comes to the Gaza conflict, that has not been as true, right, from Democrats in support of Israel.
And that's because we're seeing far too many, at least the media is showing far too many Palestinians getting caught up in this. And people are looking at that as a crisis against almost a genocidal crisis. I mean, Hamas and Israel, do what you want. But the group that's really suffering, and I think what's causing a lot of our liberals and a lot of the people on campus concern, is what's happening to the people in between, what's happening to the Palestinians. They're disenfranchised now and suffering badly. And yeah. Every day we see something, including today, mass graves. We see carnage. We see things that aren't consistent with what I think a lot of Americans believe Israel should be doing with Hamas.
So it's interesting that you just said that. So let's go right to this, because I'm not sure I'm fully in agreement, right? So yes, it is a case that it is war. Yes, it is the case that I would argue Hamas started it. So yep. A little bit, it's like if you didn't want to have this conversation with Israel, perhaps you shouldn't have gone in this direction. I think it's absolutely the case that when Palestine was doing, conscientious kind of civil disobedience, they got a lot more movement toward being supported and understood and respected by Israel. And it's not until Hamas comes into being and starts attacking that Israel starts to crack down. So I think you and I just read...
Yep.
The whole thing a little bit differently. And a little bit, I'll say Iran launched missiles at Israel. So I'm going to tell you what, Israel's sitting there by itself in an area of countries that don't really want it there and who have been threatening to annihilate it, erase it from the planet for decades. All of that is part of the context too, right?
Right. And Israel had no choice after the invasion by Hamas but to retaliate. They had to do something. And Netanyahu he's obviously seen as a very far-right leader, and people are watching him saying, what are you going to do to protect our country? And he's jumped in. And the administration has said, we are pro-Israel. Congress has said, like you indicated, pro-Israel. But there is a group of people that caught in the middle.
Yeah, so let's kind of move over to where I think it's been kind of interesting is college students have decided. So I just, oh my gosh.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I am a professor.
You're there.
I'm a professor of political science,
right.
So I want to be really clear as I wander into this. College students feel all the things, right? These are students who are aged 18 to 22. And I want to just say maybe that's the craziest version of yourself during your lifetime is age 18 to 22 because you're sure you're right about everything. You're totally immortal, right? Like everything you think is the most intelligent, most
and your
recently.
Mind is opening up.
Yes, everything's just wide open. So what's been happening is on college campuses across the country, not Weber State. So when you look at the list of campuses, okay, Greg, it is Columbia University. It is MIT. It is UPenn. So
Harvard,
we're talking
right.
Harvard. We are talking fancy pants elite colleges and universities, generally not our more
public
universities
right, sure.
are where we're seeing this, is we've got these explosions, if you will, and I mean that metaphorically, of protests. So very specifically, the story right now out of Columbia University, it's like a tent community, right, Greg? If you look at it, the students have just occupied the university. They are living in tents. They are protesting. And basically what they're saying is Columbia should get out of Gaza. So here's where you find me kind of go, so what exactly is Columbia's role to play in this interaction over between Israel and Hamas?
Yeah, and it's really come down very hard on the presidents of these universities. They've been brought before Congress and said, under what circumstance is a little anti-Semitism a good thing? You know what I mean? And I'm paraphrasing in the most worst way I probably could have. And they're trying to dance around that because they've got their students who are going, wait a minute, Israel's overstepping here a little bit. But they've got the leadership of the country, including Congress, who's grilling them, saying, wait a minute, what choice did Israel have? And I think it's a lose-lose for some of these college presidents
yeah.
who probably shouldn't even be brought to the table anyway.
Right. So let me just tell you, our legislature had a conversation this last session around institutional neutrality. And the expectation from the legislature and from the governor and from the Utah State System of Higher Education, like our governing board, was that campuses would not make statements. And a lot of people were like, well, maybe they should, right? Like, so if something's happening in the world, a campus president should say yes or no. But I'm going to tell you what, Greg, what the other side of institutional neutrality, I guess institutional partisanship would be, because what is a Columbia president supposed to say? So if they say something that is pro-Palestine, then it sounds anti-Semitic. If they say something that is pro-Israel, then the Palestinian students live in tents on the lawn of Columbia for days. If they say anything, they're going to make some group angry. And a little bit, I'm just going to tell you what, I'm not sure why we care what Columbia's position is on what's happening in Gaza. Columbia is a private institution of learning. Right? What we should care about is what our administration thinks.
But do we care? I'm going to push back. You always push back on me. I never push back on you. But do we care how the administration of a particular university deals with protests on campus when it can get agitated, when it can get to be pretty? I mean, do we care that they have these tent communities, and should the administration just say, hey, you know, that's college life and kids
will
be kids?
No, because the answer kind of is, well, I don't know. I was like, so let me just pause right there. But the answer is that campus belongs to everybody.
Sure.
So if the students have protested in such a way that other students can't get to their finals or can't get to their classes, then it's absolutely on the president to break up that protest,
then
right?
Then you're seen, though, as not supporting that protest. That's the problem that they're in. That's the problem that these presidents are in. And a couple of them have lost their jobs.
Yeah. All right. I don't think we answered that at all.
No, and I didn't push back very well.
So, but next up on KSL at Night, I don't know, Greg, if you're traveling this summer, but there's like a whole list of possible annoyances. They're going to come into your frame of reference if you start traveling. We're going to get into it after the break.
KSL at Night.
You're back with us on KSL at Night. I'm Greg Skordis alongside Leah Murray. And Leah, I have to ask you a question.
Okay, I'm ready.
Do you like traveling?
You know, I like getting places. Like when I get to the place where I'm at, I'm happy to be there.
My wife hates traveling. She's going to California tomorrow. And so she's fretting about, okay, my flight's at 9:30. Means I get to the I have to get to the airport by this time, which means I need to leave the house at this time, which means I need to wake up at this time. When I get there, how am I going to get ground transportation to where I'm going? What about the hotel? I'm like, honey, just go have fun. You're going to be with your family. You like, you know, but some people just travel just drives them nuts.
Yeah.
I personally enjoy it. But I've missed flights. I've been lost. I've lost my luggage. I mean, I just like, whatever, here we are. Let's go have some fun.
I feel like most of the time that's true for me. Sometimes but I do have post-traumatic stress around flying sometimes, right?
Oh, really?
Like, so I have been stranded in airports, right? I've spent the night in Minneapolis, spent the night in Denver. I've spent the night in Chicago, sleeping on like a really uncomfortable chair in the airport. So I feel like I can have some anxiety as soon as I start to notice like a gate change if there's a delay, right? So then I go, oh, I know the end of, I've seen this film, right? Yeah. Like the end of this is me sleeping on a really uncomfortable chair somewhere in Chicago. But I don't usually get that nervous the way you're talking about your wife doing. Does that make sense? Like I'm, once I'm in play, then I might get anxiety if I feel like things are happening.
Well, I'm going to talk about some of the things that really bother travelers. And this is one that I hadn't thought about, but a lot of people are concerned about lights in the hotel room. So, have you ever thought about that?
Yeah. So when you walk into a hotel room, right, the answer is none of the switches actually turn on a useful light.
That's a true story.
So great, right? So you
so don't close the door.
That's right. You open the door to the hotel, you flip on the light here, and it's the light right over your head. So now the entire room is pitch black still, and you've got to like crawl around to
find your bed, right?
Right. And then you like flick a switch, or the lamps are always, the lights are like you got to contort yourself to get up to wherever that switch is. I don't understand that.
And they have curtains like no other that you can make your room pitch black. I mean, like, I was in Boise the other day, and KSL was interviewing me in the morning. I think it was like at 6:45, and I'm like, I'm always up at 6:45. And literally, my call from KSL Radio woke me up.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm usually up at 5 o'clock, but that room was so dark, and I didn't appreciate the sunrise. I didn't appreciate anything. Man, I slept.
And the thing I just kind of wonder is, and maybe it's because I'm just not, how do I say? Like, the lights are never intuitive. Like, it's never turning on something that I would think this would be what you'd want to turn on.
Right.
So, obviously, whatever electrician sets up that wiring is clearly, their brain is wired differently.
No, they're messing with you. They're having fun with you. Right. Let's see what happens here.
No, and I think it's like, so I wanted to say with hotels, the coolest thing that ever happened for me traveling last year happened where I downloaded an app, like the Marriott Bonvoy app. And by the way, I stayed at a lot of hotels, so that was not like an ad for Marriott. But anyway, so I'm staying in Marriott. When I go to this conference, I download the app. I never talked to anyone because the app had my key. So I got out of my Uber, went into the hotel, went up to my hotel room, went into my hotel room.
I've never enjoyed
that. Oh, man. Right. I was like, oh, this is how life should be.
Right. No, checking into hotels is a hassle. You know, and I don't sleep particularly well in hotels. I don't know why. It just, you know, it just kind of the whole... it's not my bed. It's not my room. It's not
well,
my...
the weird thing that I do, like my tick on in conferences, when I'm by myself. So if I'm there, if I'm staying with a friend that I'm, you know, other things. But if I'm alone in a hotel room, I end up watching whatever's on TV. And it's usually like some true crime or it's like 48 Hours or whatever. Right?
Gilligan's Island reruns.
No, yeah. Not me. No, I'm watching like these crime shows. So then you're by yourself in a hotel room and you're like, this is where I die. Like
this is right. I'm not going to sleep well tonight. Yep. Right. Yes. All right. What about airlines? What problems or issues do you have with respect to that? And because, you know, that's always changing. And it seems to me, I'm interrupting before I even let you answer the question, that more and more, and maybe I've just had bad luck, I've had more delayed flights in the last couple years than I can remember. And I don't know whether it's a, and I'm sure that the airline industry is going to say we have more online, more on-time departures and arrivals than we've ever had. But it just seems like every time I'm at the airport to pick somebody up, their flight's delayed more than it has been in the past. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure. I think, I think COVID did some serious damage to the airline industry, right? And then I think kind of the labor issues we see across a lot of sectors affects the airline industry. The delays that I have had were often due to they didn't have enough pilots, right? So you've like people can't fly, right? So you can't get where you're going.
And once the early flight gets delayed, the flight from Florida to Denver is delayed, then the Denver to Salt Lake is even delayed even further.
Right, you've got to leave at 4 a.m. to make sure it doesn't get delayed.
Another thing about the airlines, and I don't know, I remember, you may not, when we had meals on every flight, when you just checked your bags.
Now, was the airline black and white when that happened, Greg?
I mean, you didn't have internet, you didn't get to watch movies, but I don't know. I kind of miss those cheesy airline
meals.
So
the answer is when they couldn't show you a movie, they had to feed you.
Yeah, they had to feed us.
Otherwise, you would go crazy.
And now they have, you know, if you want to eat, you got to pay for it. If you want drinks, you have to pay for it. If you want to check your bags, you have to pay for that. I mean, they're just things that they do more and more and more that where the airline, and maybe they're just on a tight budget, but they're charging for more and more things than I ever remember.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I was reading this article in the Wall Street Journal about airlines charging for bags, so very specifically. And the charge for bags in 2022 generated $7 billion in revenue.
Okay.
Right, so the reason
that
they are charging
that. Right. Okay, all right.
But I don't know, like I'll just be honest. I fly Delta. and I have my American Express card, and because I have that card and I'm a Sky Miles member, I've never paid for a bag, right? So that's actually, so maybe they are incentivizing joining their loyalty clubs or whatever by having people who are not in the club having to pay the fee. But also I think it has to do with how much money that's raising for them.
And I always travel light enough that I just have a carry-on, so I don't have to worry about it. A carry-on or my briefcase. I mean, that's just about it, unless it's something very long. I just don't.
I tend to not do carry-ons because I feel like, look, like I'm traveling, the last thing I need to do is be carrying my luggage. Yes.
But then you, okay, the carousel, the wait, that's just painful sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, waiting for your bags to come off. That's just another thing. Do you enjoy traveling by car? Is that something you do much?
Oh, yeah, road trips all the time.
I mean, my wife hates it because bothers her back or something. It's just like she wants to fly, but I mean, we're going to Vegas for Memorial Day. And I'm like, let's drive. She's like, no way, we're flying.
So by the way, I would never fly to Vegas. So here's my rule is if it's within a 6-hour drive, then by the time you're parking at the airport,
that's
getting there
exactly right.
Time, going through security, you have driven there.
Right.
So I would much rather drive when we're within 6 hours. I drive to New York pretty much almost every year because when I go home in the summer to visit family, that's how I get there is I drive. Those are epic road trips with my family. But I'll tell you what, Greg, when we're doing business trips, I got to get there and get in and get out. Does that make sense? So I'm not driving to California for a business trip. I'm going to fly in and fly out.
I'm also reading that new federal rules for airline refunds, and this is a little bit off topic, require that they give you cash instead of a voucher.
Yes.
I'm not sure why that is.
All right, so let's talk about that, right? So I have been stranded a number of times. So this airline industry doesn't do a good job getting me where I'm going. So I am sleeping in a really uncomfortable chair in Minneapolis, Denver, or Chicago. Those are the three airports
that you've been stuck in.
I have been traumatized by. And then they say to you, here's a voucher to fly later. And the answer is like, yeah, I don't know that I want to fly in United ever
okay,
again. So
point.
What I would rather have you do is give me cash for my inconvenience
right.
And the fact that you didn't get me where you said you could get me. I think I'm here for it.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, do you have any travel plans in the next couple of months?
Yeah, I'll be headed to Detroit for a conference. I'm going to tell you what, getting from Salt Lake to Detroit without stopping 4 times is very expensive
yeah,
right
I think
now.
Stop. It's worth to me. Paying the extra for a nonstop.
Yeah, me too.
And the older I get, the closer I want to get to the front of the airplane. I mean, the business class. I'm not quite to the first class yet, but I like to get in a little better seat if I can.
I'll tell you what, I've flown first class twice by accident, and wow.
Oh, it's nice.
Oh, it's very nice.
Yep,
yeah,
very nice. When we come back after the break, I think you're going to get me on this one because you're going to talk about a product that I don't know much about, which seems to happen a lot between you and I. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas. Greg, you and I have talked about a lot of stuff for like 2 years.
Yes.
I feel like we cover all the things.
And you're always on top of all the new wave things.
Yeah, and you like are to, not.
And I'm having a hard time with that, but I've learned a lot.
So here's the thing, listeners. If you want to go back in time and listen to Greg talk about his black and white history, meaning he grew up when there wasn't color TV, you could certainly do that. And how you would do that is you would go to kslpodcast.com. You would Google, or not Google, you would put
in... I was wondering
in,
where you were going with this. You're promoing. Look
I'm
at you.
I'm promoing. Look at me.
You're such
so
a
you
team
would
player.
Go to kslpodcast.com and you would look up KSL at Night. And I wonder if you could search, Greg doesn't know what a charcuterie board is.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Because that's one of my favorite shows we did. So anyway, but that I'm totally teasing as I'm promoing. Podcasts, we've got them. Every show that we have, I would say anywhere really that you get your podcast, any app, you can find KSL at Night and you can listen to it. So talking about podcasts and makes me think about technology.
Right.
Makes me think about things you don't know much about. But I wanted to kind of get into kind of legal stuff around technology, which is actually something you know quite a bit about, right,
yes.
Greg? So, okay. I just bought a new car this weekend. And one of the questions that I asked to the dealer when I was buying it, because they were like, here's all the cool stuff. And there's an app on your phone and I can like start my car right now and it will run for 15 minutes and I can like lock it. I get a message that says you forgot to lock your car and I can lock it with this app. And it collects all this data and it tells me where I'm going and I can blah, 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 blah. And my answer or my question really was, so do you collect all this data and then you give it to an insurance company,
right, yes.
right? And the car company that I was buying from said, no. I was like, do you promise?
Yeah. Cross your heart.
Cross your heart. And they were like, yeah, no, no. We just, that data is just for you. So I am kind of interested, Greg, in how all of these cool gadgets and gizmos that we have, that technology that I am all in, because I'm a gadgety person and I love anything that like makes my life more convenient and easier. But I'm also really concerned about privacy issues, right? So the thing on the cars is I am aware that they're collecting data. I am aware that if there's a LoJack on my car, and then if my husband and I were to break up and he had access to that LoJack, that pretty much for the rest of the life of that car, he could find where I was, right? Which feels like, even if we didn't break up, if he has that LoJack on his phone, he can find where I am if he has that app. Yeah.
LoJack?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard that word.
Okay. Maybe your Tesla has one. Maybe your wife knows everywhere you are by looking at the LoJack. So there's this app that allows me to see where my car is. And I can see, like, it's called LoJack, and so, it allows me to know right where my car is.
I've never even heard of that before.
Right, and I could see where it's moved. I can look at the activity to see how long I've driven it. How fast was I going? So the sell to me at the dealer...
Things you don't want to know. Right.
Right, but the sell was like, your teenage daughter's going to drive this car, this will be great to know, right? And
right.
I was like, yeah, I'm going to stalk her. I'll know everywhere she is. And Greg Scordis, I can put a geofence on my car so that if she drives out of a certain geographic area, I'm going to get a beep that goes, someone's taking your car far away from where you say it's supposed to be.
It doesn't activate the brakes, however.
No.
You hit the geofence and boom.
No,
hey, mom, the car doesn't run
dog.
Anymore.
Oh,
I just hit St. George and the car stopped. What's going on here?
Yes, boom. That's what happens right there. Boom.
It
no.
shocked me.
But all of that's cool, right? I guess. Like me tracking right. my teenagers is cool, I guess. But it does kind of beg the tech question, doesn't it, Greg? So let me introduce the story about the Ring that made me think about all of this. And then let's dive into what privacy means in a
sure.
world of technology.
Sure.
So apparently, the Federal Trade Commission is sending more than $5.6 million in refunds to consumers as part of a settlement they have with Ring. So I have a Ring doorbell. Just like the LoJack on my car, I could right now on an app on my phone pull up my front porch and I can look at it. My favorite thing that happened with my Ring doorbell was my husband walked out to the car carrying his skis over his shoulder and it was an icy day. And he hit a patch of ice. Boom, down he went. So I posted that on TikTok and that was great. And I got more watches of that video than most videos I've ever had. So I'm really here for that. That's funny to
sure.
like watch people fall on ice, I guess.
So why did Ring get dinged?
Well, hang on. So
okay, okay.
But also I can set it like a little geofence. So I can say if there is a package in front of my house, so I can put a little box in front of my door. Did UPS drop off a package? Okay. So I guess all of that video feed, which for the record, people put Ring videos like on TikTok all the time, and I
sure.
will just
right.
roar with laughter at what happens in front of people's front doors. But FTC, about a year ago, accused Ring of allowing employees to access those videos. So the... like, I guess the idea would be if I worked for Amazon, I could track and get access to the videos of people's Ring doorbells, like
sure.
their Ring, the cameras on the front of their house.
What's the problem with it? I mean, just I understand this, the privacy interest. So the FTC
has that
employees of Ring can access their customers' videos. They can go in and watch what you're seeing.
Right.
Well, yeah, I can understand that being a privacy interest problem.
I mean, like, so the thing, I think the question that I have around this, and let's talk about it a little bit, is that, so let's go to one that might actually matter to you.
Sure.
Okay, so let's say there is, not that everything matters to you, Greg, I don't mean it that way, but like that you might have some unique insight on. So let's say that in front of my house, a crime happens,
mm-hmm.
and then someone like drives a car off, right? Like, so they maybe something happens and then they're driving away. And the police basically say, I want to see the camera footage. Because now what I have all across communities
right.
is evidence, all of these private cameras, and Ring allows police departments to have it. right? So Ring basically goes.
So Ring said, right, we will give you that information.
Right, so we have got these videos and you're tracking something. And then maybe, so the question is, of course I love my Ring. I love catching my husband falling on the ice carrying his skis. I love knowing that there's a package in front of my door. I love that when the doorbell rings, I can look and go, yeah, I'm not answering for that person. We're like, all of that makes Ring fabulous. My favorite is when someone comes to the house and they ring the bell and you're not home and you can talk to them. Right. So you have a whole conversation with whoever's at the front door. All that's super cool. All that's super... Right? Like convenient. I feel like I'm living in the Jetsons. It's really cool.
But it's yours. It's your information.
Yeah, but shouldn't it be? Right? So that's maybe where I want to go. Like, so can the police, not can, should they could, should the Ring company be making those videos available to police? Should the Ring company be making those videos that maybe I'm going to post on TikTok? So, you know, how private is it actually? Available to their employees? To what extent should I be able to... Right? Like stalk my teenage kid driving my car using my LoJack. And I just, when the FTC basically says to Ring, you are allowing people to access private videos, you cannot do it. We're going to give $5.6 million of the, you know, I guess the fine, right, that they had to pay back to consumers. You know what I mean? Like,
I think there's an easy fix for that.
Go.
And I'll tell you what it is. And that is that if Ring had said in its brochures, your information is our information.
Like that you just said brochure.
Well, whatever.
Because you know what? Everyone reads a brochure
Nobody
today.
Does brochures. Okay. But so we have this concept in the law that I talk about a lot called the reasonable expectation of privacy. What is your reasonable expectation of privacy? When you buy a Ring doorbell, it's that... I guess what you would say is that it's my proprietary information.
Maybe. But I'm asking the question.
Maybe if Ring says, look, when you buy this product, you should know that the Ring monkey mucks can access your information and we may even give it to other people. It's the same thing with that whole DNA thing, right? When we used to say DNA and we're getting a DNA test, but then they're sharing it with law enforcement. What was your expectation of privacy when you had the test? What was your expectation of privacy when you buy the Ring doorbell? And apparently... The FTC felt, and I'm just reading between the lines, because for them to issue a $5.6 million fine in the way of refunds makes me think that Ring was not forthcoming about that information, or at least that they should have been much more forthcoming.
Or that no one got the brochure. All right.
You're
Greg Skordos, it is always a pleasure chatting about anything new in tech with you. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us for the best 2 hours of radio you possibly could have been listening to know all the things you need to know. Thank you for listening to KSL at Night.